So the title of the talk and the theme is what you might call ordinary magic. The magic of the ordinary. And all of us are here in some deep way to find their inner freedom or our inner freedom and the magic of life and a sense of liberation. And it's something we know but we forget. And it's also not clear what we have to pay, what price we have to pay for living with magic, living a liberated life. It's often not clear what we have to do for it, what we have to give up in order to really live a liberated and awakened life. One of the things we need to give up is our obsession with the known, what seems to be known and what seems to be us and ours. And I'll just offer a small example. If we all lift up our hand, just lift it up, lift our hand and have a look at it. And it seems very obvious, first of all, that it's a hand, and that we define it as a hand, and secondly, that we recognize it, and thirdly, that it's ours. All of those are assumptions. Do we really know what this thing is? Do we really know? We learnt it. From the age of 1 year old, we learnt this is a hand and this is mine. First of all, it's a big chutzpah to say this hand, which is created by the universe, which is made of the same stuff that the stars are made of, that no one, that we didn't invent it and we didn't buy it and we didn't get it. It came here, it came, and it's mine. It's like saying, life is mine. This is life. It's part of the universe, and it's mine. So already we're in a situation of illusion. By just that sense of ownership, already puts us in illusion, and it's something that is blocking us, our freedom. And the same with definition. This is a hand. But is it really a hand? It's just a convention to say this is a hand. If we, in our meditation today, we experience it as a mass of sensations, lived experiences. When we look at the body, it's just alive. It doesn't say hand, foot, head. It's just the lived flow of life. So hand is a concept, which we learned. If we give up a concept like this is my hand and this is a hand and this belongs to me, if we give up those concepts that we learnt, what's left? What's left if we don't define this as hand? If we take all the definitions away, what's left? Nothing? No. My first meeting with the Buddhist teaching was in the 60s, when I happened to arrive at a house in Hampstead in London, where there was advertised a Buddhist monk who's going to give an evening. I didn't know what to expect. We all sat down there, and he said, go into a guided kind of imagination. Imagine that you took your hand and you put it in the corner of the room. And all the people in the room here took their hands and made a pile of hands in one corner. Then you took the right leg and made a pile of right legs in the other corner. Then you took your eyes out and put them in a pile in the middle of the room. And we went through this until there was nothing left. They were all piles of pieces of body. And then he said, yeah, that's the exercise. Bye-bye. And there is a point to it, to challenge the automatic, that what we know is truth, is obvious, we don't question it, we forget that it needs all the conditions of the world to make us, and all sorts of conditions to make us, to help us know these things. And they're not inherent in reality. There is the filter, it's the filter, the way we look at reality. So we very much work with that today. In the first day of the retreat, we worked with the body, exploring the body. First of all, a little bit calming down, because until we calm down, there's not much that we can really deeply see. If it's like looking in a pool, if there's lots of waves on the pool, we really can't see what's under the pool, under the water. So it's calming the waves so that we can see more clearly what's inside. And we looked and we saw mostly pains here, pains there, discomfort, why am I have to sit 45 minutes, when's the bell going to ring, and that's a lot of what the body was telling us. But also, we began, I hope, to open the body as a field of awareness. Now, mostly what we do with the body is try and forget it. Unless it hurts, we basically say, okay, it's a good tool. It's like we ride the body like we ride a chamor, an ass. As long as it's working, we forget it. And if it's not working properly, we give it a few hits, a cup of coffee and ambition to get it going again, putting a carrot in front of the donkey and keep going in our daily life. And we basically use it. And we don't pay that much attention. We forget this body. We forget that we walk, we forget that we breathe, we forget that we have a head until we have a headache. And then we quickly take an Akamol in order to forget again that we have a head. So, what we're doing here is going in the opposite direction. We are trying to make what it seems to be uninteresting, namely the body as it is, to become interesting, to become, in a way, magical. If we really looked at one step, it's magical. How all the parts of the body know to do this incredible thing, which is to walk on this earth. It's the umuvan meilav. It's not an automatic thing. It's a magical thing if we open our eyes and actually look. So, what we're doing with the body as the first step in the journey of this retreat is opening the world of forgetting, the world of pushing away, the world that feels not interesting, not special, just ordinary body doing its thing. No, it's not ordinary. The body is a lived body. As much as we can be intimate with the lived body, we are intimate with life itself. And that's no small thing. That's a big thing. And it also tells us that if we're looking for spirituality somewhere else, we may be looking in the wrong direction. If we're kind of creating worlds in which the body is just a functional chamor and a donkey, and the spirit and the divine is somewhere else, that we have to leave the body, leave life, in order to kind of hunger for something beyond. That's also challenged by our intimacy with the lived body. It says, wait a minute, maybe through the seeing of the ordinary, I can see everything. It's not ordinary at all. It's me that needs to see. And I will then see that this thing called body is not ordinary. The relationship with the body is very dynamic. It's very open. It's very alive. We may begin to see that although there's pain and discomfort, I don't need to be the victim. I can be the partner. Not pleasant, pain in the back. We wish it wasn't there. But instead of being the victim, we can begin to be a partner, enter a dialogue with this uncomfortable sensation called my pain. Begin to realize that pain is just also an invitation, an expression of life, not a problem, but an invitation to pay attention. And we begin to see even the body in pain as a place that's workable, that is possible to work with. Not just a thing that's a problem that we have to just deal with just to keep the donkey going. So in some way, the body can move for us from being a uninteresting, defined and object that we possess and use, into a kind of a window through which we see reality, through which we can see the universe, through which we can see life flowing in all its different forms and colors. But we need to look straight at it. In a way, what's helpful to us, and why we sit here 45 minutes and not just 2 minutes like we usually look at things. Why we really go into it to look deeply is to look under the water and see what's at the bottom of the pool. If we do that, we'll see a lot of mud. There will be difficulty. There will be mud at the bottom of the pool. But there will also be diamonds. But if we don't look through the water, if we don't really look with a penetrating gaze into the simplest of experiences, like, what are my fingers saying right now? What's the sensation of touch? What's the sensation of touching the ground? What is a breath Who does it belong to? Who's in control of it? Where can I feel this breath? Can I feel it in my fingers? In my feet? Where is this breath? What is happening? The opening and opening, kind of peeling the layers. That's looking underneath, and there we will see, we will discover the non-ordinary. We can establish a new relationship with things that are, we call problems. Problems are also definitions. They're definitions. Hagdarot. We describe something, this is a problem that disturbs me. Maybe a problem of the body, maybe a problem in life, maybe a problem of relationships with people, maybe a problem with ourselves, maybe a psychological pattern, maybe habits that give us difficulty. But there needs, for it to be a real problem, we need to define it as a problem. We need to say, this is what disturbs me. Now, in other words, we need to put it up on the bama, on the stage, and say, this is the thing that is troubling me. And that too can be questioned. Do we really need to hold something on the stage as a problem? Or can we drop it? Can we see it's also dynamic? It's also changing. There is a nice image from Ramana Maharshi who said that our problems are like suitcases, mizvadot. We're on the train, the train is carrying us, why do we need to carry our suitcases? Why don't we put them down and let the train take us and the bags? So let the train of life take us and our problems. Why do we have to carry problems? We carry them because we define them as problems that are problems for us. We create an ownership. Balut. We create, this is my problem. I have to deal with this problem. It's affecting me. It's on my shoulders. As we develop a new way of looking, which is looking under the water, which is a gaze through the under the surface, through what seems to be true, we gaze through things, then everything takes on a different kind of meaning. The biggest problem that we can think of will, and we're sitting here turning it in our minds and getting totally under it, and the whole thing goes as soon as the bell rings for lunch. Suddenly, where's the problem? Gone. It means it wasn't really ours in the first place. It stuck. It got stuck. We got stuck to it. It got stuck to us. And then the bell came. End of problem. It's just a bell. Stopped all the problems. And we're saying, oh, lunch. So things arrive in our life. And as we develop, the meditation is a way of developing a consciousness, an awareness that's penetrating into the truth of things that are arising and passing away, helping us to drop things that are on our shoulders, a sense that we can look at our life and it's workable, It's raw material, chomer gelim, it's workable. A sense that we can be a mirror and not an owner. That things that come up, we can just be the mirror. We can reflect life as it arises. We don't have to own everything and have it all on us. We can see it, again, under the water. It's just the mud underneath the water. We don't have to identify with it to be it. It's in the use of our consciousness that we can find a way to be free in the middle of the ordinary, in the middle of the problems of life. It's the way we use consciousness, the way we use our minds. This is quite a different attitude, and it's very much core truth of the Dharma. The Dharma, or the practice that we're doing, is much more interested in developing tools of awareness than in actually what happens to us. The assumption is that if we have the right tools of awareness, then anything that happens to us is workable, is possible. We can deal with things as they turn up. But what we have to do is open the seeing eye, the awareness, open a kind of global awareness that we know what's going on and we see things as they arise and pass away, and we are like a mirror watching, like a witness, allowing things, allowing the whole of life to come and to pass in front of our eyes. And there is a place of freedom. It's being not controlled, but inside life. Not controlled by things that happen to us, but right in the middle of life. Not distant. It starts, what we started with is stopping, is quietening down. And we mentioned that yesterday, and we've been doing that today. Today has been arriving, settling down, stopping, and letting the habits a little bit soften the habits of our life. Just settling down, stopping is kind of important. Which is why I, by the way, like the kind of the inner meaning of Shabbat, which I'm always find it joyful to reflect on Shabbat, and its inner or ancient meaning is stopping. And what does stopping mean? It doesn't mean become a vegetable. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't walk and look and see and be and eat and rest, but it means reducing the interference, the compulsion to change things, to fix things, to be better, to want to do things, to change the world as if the world isn't perfect. The Shabbat has a quality of behind it of perfection, that God made the world and it was done, finished, and it's good. And stopping in our own practice may allow us, when things settle down, to see actually there's nothing that needs to be changed now, that nothing needs to be fixed, that I can rest from the need to be better or to be righter or to be good or to be anything. And there's something in there which is an important message inside the stopping, that we stop not as a force, like we have to be frozen, but we stop because we don't need to interfere with reality. to be controller. There's a nice sentence that always touches me from the Buddhist suttas about a story of someone called Angulimala, who was a brigand, Shodedyar. He was, and he killed many, many, many people in the forest. And the Buddha said to his monks, "I want to go and see this man, Angulimala. He's suffering, and he's making others suffer." So Angulimala was there in the forest. The Buddha went in, and he started. He was walking, and Angulimala found him and ran after him. And the Buddha was walking peacefully, and Angulimala was running but couldn't catch up with him. And the Buddha was simply walking, and Angulimala running to try and catch up. And Angulimala said to him, "Stop, stop." And the Buddha turned around and said, "No, you stop. I stopped a long time ago." It's a very beautiful phrase, rings in my mind a lot, touches me, this phrase. And that was such a shock to Angulimala to get such a response that it shook him out of the usual habit of killing people. And he said, "I don't understand. People only have done three things. They've either ran away and I killed them, or they fought me and I killed them, or they begged for mercy and I killed them. And you don't do that." And the Buddha said, "Yeah, just stop this pain that you're in, and others too." There's a sort of deep inner quality of stopping, which I'm trying to pass in language, which is not being, is not stopping. What we're doing here is not stopping in a frozen kind of way, but we're stopping the sense that we have to interfere and be busy with things. The stopping is a kind of letting things be what they are. That's a deeper kind of stopping. Not manipulating the world, which is what we really keep trying to do, because we find the world difficult. So we're busy trying to fix it and fix ourselves and have more things and buy more things. And so this sort of stopping we're doing is like the Beatles song, "Let It Be." Just let it be. That's a deeper place of stopping. Someone asked the Buddha, "How do you cross the flood of samsara of this world to the other side?" And the Buddha said, by not sinking and by not struggling. In other words, if I stopped and sank, I would drown in samsara, and if I struggled against life, I would get swept away. So by not sinking and not struggling, I cross the flood. So it's a subtle place, it's in between, it's not non-doing, because we're doing here. Sometimes it's quite difficult what we're doing here, to sit 45 minutes and the back hurts and this, and we get bored and we get restless and we're not used to it. So it's active, and yet letting it be. Active being with things, let them be. It's the second part of what we're doing is the seeing. You can even say vipassana. It's seeing. seeing deeply, looking under the surface of the water, looking at the mud and occasionally the diamonds down there. And it's an experience, it's experience of experience. It's actually seeing what it is when I experience something. What is happening when I walk? What is happening when I breathe? What is the experience? Very, very simple things. What is the real experience of what's happening now? That's seeing. That's looking under the surface. One image that comes from a Thai meditation master is that oil and water, when you shake it up, becomes a kind of a milk. And when you let it settle, by stopping and by quietness, the oil and the water become separate. The oil is like our consciousness, and the water is our experience. So that if the oil and the water become separate, we're not entirely inside our experience, in which we can't see it anymore. It's like our back hurts, and all we can do is, oh, my back hurts, and I wish it would go, and what to do. We're inside it. If we step back and become the witness, Ha'ed, we step out of it, we become the witness of the hurting back, or of thoughts that arise. We can, we're not lost inside our experience. We are watching what's going on. We're developing a free witness mind which can contain our experience with awareness. And so that sometimes that needs us to step back, especially when we're watching thought. It's something we're going to talk about, and you get guidance on this later on in the retreat. And I want to give a talk on it later on in the retreat. The work with thought. But for the moment, it's already useful that when thought comes, we can still be walking. We can still feel the body. We have the power to step out of thought and be the witness. And this is something we're growing day by day here. In the practice, we are growing a kind of ability or a power to be the witness of our life, day by day. And it does things. You know, usually the neuroscience tells us that generally people use 10% of their brain. I think if you checked how much brain you're using before a retreat and after a retreat, I think you'd find you added 1 or 2% of use. Because just think, again, walking, the feet are intelligent. They know what they're doing. We forget that there's intelligence in the body. That intelligence is part of our life. It's in the brain, it's in awareness. We forget the intelligence of the body. We forget so much how we can look more carefully at our whole life. As we practice, we will notice maybe the flowers, the little flowers that on the side of the road, of the path. We will notice an insect crossing the path. We will notice the shape of the clouds. We will notice, listen to the birds. We will be disturbed by things. Maybe the muezzin disturbed because it was very loud this morning. Doesn't matter. It can be disturbing or not disturbing. It can be pleasant or unpleasant. But the noticing is happening more and more. And as we do that, our power of mind is increased. We're not in a narrow kind of maslul, a narrow form of looking where we only look at what interests us and what we ought to do and what we ought to think. We're also widening the field to look at things that are not so interesting for us. The small flowers by the side of the path, the look in the eyes of someone in the as we pass them by, the way my feet feels as I touch the earth, what the earth feels like, what the sky feels like, who I am right now, how I am right now. And this witnessing is really an interesting place because it's a little bit like the white page on which the writing is written. We normally are only busy with the writing. What's written on the page, what I have, what I need to do, what I think, who I am, what I should do tomorrow, where I need to go, writing on the page. The witnessing, the sense of containing our life in awareness, which is what we're doing here, is interest in the white page on which the writing is written. It's not just the writing. It's some background awareness that we are alive. We are here. There is life here. There is awareness. There is consciousness. It's not the same as the content. HaTochen. There's the tochen, which is a bit like the water, and then there's the consciousness, which is a bit like the oil. The water and the oil. We become interested in consciousness. That is different from content. It's our ability to be aware of content that arises and passes by, and we're here, present. The word presence was used many times already in the instructions. Nochut. It's an important word. Being present means the consciousness is there, ready to receive whatever arises in the field of consciousness. It's giving interest to our consciousness. And consciousness is free. There's no problems in consciousness. The content is where the problems are. Not the consciousness itself. Consciousness is just awareness. It has no problems. The problems are in what arises in consciousness and how we relate to that. Meaning we are back into reacting to what happens to us day by day. But the consciousness itself, the white page, is just white page. Pure, white. There was a very dramatic image in the Buddhist text it's kind of a powerful image that's a bit of a shock about the content that arises in our life, the tochen, the things that arise and how we are busy with it. And it's in a sutta called the Fire Sutta, a fire sermon. And the Buddha said, monks, there was 1,000 monks listening to him, he said, "Monks, everything is burning." That's a strong statement. Everything is burning. What is burning? The senses are burning. The eyes, the ears, the senses are burning. The forms that we see, the contents that comes in through the senses is burning. Consciousness that is busy with the senses is burning. Whatever arises when the senses are contacting the world is burning. What's it burning with? It's burning with obsession, with interest, with what I need, with my security, with my desires, with my busyness, with not enough, with has to be more, with the constant busyness with what is arising through the senses. And the image of burning is a strong one. We're burning up the planet right now. Through busyness, through more, through wanting to drive everywhere, fly everywhere, and burn everything, and consume everything, and it's a. He goes on. The intellect, the sechel, the intellect is burning. Ideas are burning. Consciousness in the intellect, in the mind, is burning. And seeing this. The movement to drop, to cool down, is to become, in English you call, the translation is disenchanted, to get out of the spell, to kind of let it go, to let it be, to quieten down, to wake up from this dance of doing, of burning, of being in a way all the time. Agitated. And it's interesting that you've all heard the word Nibbana or Nirvana as a word meaning awakening, but the translation of it is cooling. It's to cool or put out the fires. And it's an interesting image to put out the fire, to cool down. It's not so clear, and it's very much in the Buddhist world, we're not talking about going somewhere else that's better. Meaning, everything is burning, 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 so putting out the fire and going beyond somewhere else, to go to above place, to go to, that awakening is going to, into another special state of mind called holiness, some sacred space. And we're holy in that place. It's not other. It's cooling down, and because the image of Nibbana, and it's an Eastern image, is when fire goes out, it actually returns to the universe. The problem isn't fire. The problem is that it's concentrated in this being that's burning up with interests and needs and restless and wanting. It's concentrated here. As soon as this is cooled down, it goes back to the universe. So meaning that the awakening, the process of awakening, is actually returning to the universe. That's what awakening is. It's waking up from an automatic place into the awareness, the place of return, the place of being with the world and this being as one thing, returning to the universe where we are, that we forgot. Someone asked the Buddha at one time, What does it mean to put out the fire? And the Buddha said, tell me, when you put out a fire, do you say that it... Where's the fire gone? Do you know where the fire went when you put it out? Does it go east? Does it go west? Does it go north? Does it go south? Who can say where it went? And it's a really interesting image because it says that awakening is not going somewhere else. We think of it like that. We want awakening or liberation. We want to be liberated. We want to be free. And we consider it to be a certain state that we want to enter. But it can be that it's a totally opposite situation. It's not a state that we enter. It's just that we leave this place called burning, and we just find ourselves back home in the universe, and we can't say that that's another place. It's everything. It's not higher. We're here. We want to be there. Because of that, many people don't understand some of the philosophical issues in the Dharma, in the Buddhist teaching, and kind of expects that the Buddhist teaching will have ontological answers. With all this meditation I'm doing, surely I'm going to be able to solve the problems of life. But mostly when the ontological questions, the ultimate questions are asked, from the time of the Buddha until today, they are simply the responses. This is not a legitimate question. It's going in the wrong direction. For example, the question, what is the meaning of life, is regarded as a kind of wrong question, because when everything is meaningful, so how can you, then the question has no more relevance. It doesn't take you in any direction. If the small flowers on the side of the path, if the birds flying across the sky, if the leaves on the trees, if the cold and the warmth, if the body and the life in the body, and everything is meaningful, then there's no point in asking, what's the meaning of life? It's a no-go. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't take you anywhere. So it's an illegitimate question. It's just a thought to try and somehow philosophize away the unknown. A thought arising because of fear of the unknown. I have chickens at home. And many times people in the Tovana community say, we must tell us chicken stories in the and it's I do spend a lot of time watching my chickens, and I sometimes go in there to their home where they're really kind of quite happy. When you look at life from the chicken point of view, coming out of the human point of view and the chicken point of view, there is magic there. You see the way that the chickens, I see the way that my chickens know exactly what they're trying to do, have a huge, interesting relationship with each other that's constantly changing. Have their world, have their consciousness, have their language. You can't believe what a rich society is, a chicken society. I never knew it until I sat there for some hours. So I used to go there and meditate inside the chicken house just to watch these. The discovery that you see some a bird that you think doesn't have much brain and is rather stupid and is just there to give you eggs, and then you see even worse the millions of chickens that are just there to be eaten, white chickens frustrated and you know, in the kibbutzim, the moshavim, the way the chickens are, or everywhere in the world, the chickens are industrial objects that have no brain. And the difference when you actually sit with them and you see, you begin to notice, but you need a lot of looking, the subtle language that they have between them, and you realize, wow, there's worlds and worlds and worlds here. But I'm just saying that because of the issue of meaningfulness. When you look at things more deeply, everything becomes unfolded, becomes open and meaningful. So a question, what's the meaning of life, just loses its point. And the same with beliefs. The Buddhist teaching is not happy with beliefs. It says seeing is instead of beliefs. Beliefs is simply an act of insecurity. So you're frightened of the unknown, so you have to cover it with belief systems, and your beliefs are usually what other people say, and what other people tell you. This is another big misunderstanding in the Dharma, which is often assumed to be atheist, that there's no God. There isn't no God, it's just that there's no belief that there is the divine in everything. It just needs you to see the godness that is not separate from anything in life. That's the ordinary magic. The divine, the godness, is right here in every little thing. It cannot be anywhere else. It just needs us to be there with it, to receive it, to be connected to it, to open our eyes and to see under filter out of the way, the sinun. The closest word, I think, to, if you like, the divine in the Dharma would be tathāta. And tathāta means isness. It is. A bit like the name of God. Who am I? It's isness. Tathāta is similar to, I would say, more or less the same, I don't know the language, but it's more or less the same as Asheriyah. Isness is the thing, that is the divine. The Buddha, the name of the Buddha was Tathāgata, meaning gone to isness. I don't know how to gone to isness. Kahut maybe it would be isness, but I don't think that in either in English nor in Hebrew there isn't really a good word for it. Such kacha, that's it. It is zeu zeh. This is it. There isn't anything else. There is it. It is. And that's about as far as words can go. But the Buddha was called Tathagata, meaning gone to isness, or come from isness. So that's all I'm going to say. And the bottom line is, keep awake. Keep open, let things be revealed slowly and naturally, drop the burdens as they arrive, be the witness to our life moment by moment. Thank you. Let's take a couple of minutes of silence.